he's going to show us slides on the hurricane of 1938, and he's going to talk to us about that.
Hello.
Oh.
Good morning.
Morning.
We're just starting the program, Jerry, so find yourself a seat now.
Jerry, are you going to?
We're going forward.
Good morning. My name is John Horrigan. I'm a New England folklorist and weather historian, a historical astronomer. I also study great fires, the economy, and I'm a professional sports announcer part-time. And it's a great pleasure to be here at the Winthrop Council on Aging to speak here for you folks in the Winthrop Low Vision Group. My lecture today is The Great Hurricane in 1938. Some of the walk-in music you heard was Tisket Tasket by Ella Fitzgerald, Begin the Begwin by Artie Shaw, Don't Be That Way by Benny Goodman. Now today we're going to look at the snapshot of the Great Hurricane of 38, or the GH-38. We're going to ask the question, what is a hurricane? Look at a history of North Atlantic hurricanes, the Great Colonial Hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, the track and factoids. We'll look at the summer of 38, the MUF forecast, a record low air pressure, and then we'll travel to New York City, Long Island, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and then up to Massachusetts, and then finally we'll look at the death of this monster. Now with GH-38, there were acts of bravery and cowardice, acts of kindness and selfishness, providence, luck, and cruel fate. Up until that time, this was the most costly disaster in U.S. history. It was a lateral buzzsaw. Nobody was prepared because nobody was warned. We see unlikely heroes, and by the time it died out on September 28, 1938, 10 states and 2 countries were affected. When you hear about hurricanes, you hear about Category 1, Category 2, Category 3, 4, 5. A Category 1 hurricane has wind speeds of 74 to 95 miles per hour. A Category 3, which we think the GH-38 was, had speeds between 111 and 130 miles per hour. And a Category 5 has winds in excess of 155 miles per hour. Now, what kills people in hurricanes? It's not the wind, it's storm surge. Storm surge is a dome of water 40 to 60 miles long that moves onto the shoreline near the landfall point of the eye of the hurricane. As this water is constantly slamming into shoreline structures, even well-built structures quickly get demolished. As the waters move inland, more debris floats along with it, causing further damage. Storm surge is responsible for nearly 90,000 of all hurricane-related deaths and injuries. In fact, in India, in 1876, 200,000 people died due to storm surge and drowned. In Haiphong, China, in 1881, 300,000 people died. We also have wind damage. As we know, the force of wind can quickly decimate the tree population, and you're going to see that with GH-38. Knocks down power lines, signs. It can destroy homes and buildings. And flying debris can also cause damage. If people are caught outdoors, it usually results in injuries or death. Also, tornadoes are known to form when hurricanes make landfall. The torrential rains that are associated in the subsequent flooding with hurricanes also cause deaths and injuries. The storm surge and highest winds are concentrated near the eye of a hurricane, and the rain may extend for hundreds of miles and may last for several days, affecting areas well after the hurricane has diminished. Now here in the United States, the vulnerable East Coast stretches from basically the Mexican and Texas Gulf of Mexican shoreline all the way around the peninsula of Florida and all the way up the eastern seaboard into Maine and even Nova Scotia. If you take a study of all hurricanes over the past 100 years, they're born in the oceans, the warm oceans, off of West Africa. They track westward and then northwestward, and then they change directions. They get caught up with the Gulf Stream. They either head north, they head out to sea, or they head into the Gulf of Mexico. Now, one of the things that we find if we analyze sedimentary deposits, that we know that there were major hurricane strikes along the New England coast long before the Anglo-Saxons arrived. We know that an intense hurricane struck New England between the years 1100 and 1150. Another one hit 1300 to 1400 AD. Another one 1400 to 1450. And then the next one, 1635, the Great Colonial Hurricane, the Great September Gale of 1815, and Saxby's Gale of 1869. Now, I often wonder, had Columbus chosen a different year to come across the Atlantic, he most assuredly would have been swallowed up by a hurricane. He came across the Atlantic in October. Not a good time to come across in the tropics. But he missed a hurricane and discovered the West. The Great Colonial Hurricane is the first recorded hurricane to strike the United States, recorded by, of course, the white men. It took place on August 16, 1635. That's the old style Julian calendar. According to Governor John Winthrop, quote, "It blew with such violence, with abundance of rain, that it blew down many hundreds of trees, overthrew some houses, and drove ships from their anchors. The tide rose at Narragansett 14 feet higher than ordinary and drowned 8 Indians flying from their wigwams. The ship Angel Gabriel was destroyed and 21 lives were lost." We know that the eye passed to the south and east of Boston. And in Plymouth, according to William Bradford, quote, "It caused the sea to swell to the south wind of this place above 20 foot right up and down and made many of the Indians climb into trees for their safety. It continued above 5 or 6 hours, but the violence began to abate. It blew down many hundreds of thousands of trees. The signs and marks of it will remain this 100 years in these parts." And of course, he says, "The moon suffered a great eclipse the second night after it." So Bradford recognizes the damage caused by this hurricane, and that the signs of this hurricane will be there for years to come. And that is the case with the hurricane of 38. There were downed trees into the woods well into the early 60s. The other great hurricane of New England is the Great September Gale of 1815. It hit on Saturday, September 23rd, 1815. According to Noah Webster, quote, "The storm was a proper hurricane. It was one of several severe storms that struck the North Atlantic shipping lanes that season. It struck Long Island near Center Mariches, and Montauk Point Lighthouse was heavily damaged. In the East River in New York, wharves were underwater by 3 feet at 10 in the morning, and the eye of the hurricane passes to the east of Hartford, Connecticut, and Springfield, Mass. In the Hampshire Gazette, they say it's a tornado of wind and rain. At Yale University in New Haven, they get 6.5 inches of rain over 2 days. According to the New Haven Register, it drifted several hogshead of rum and molasses from the wharf. Eastern Connecticut, all of Rhode Island, and east central Massachusetts were raked by the storm. The rain had a saline or salty flavor to it. Houses and trees had a white hue from the ocean froth. It whipped up 90-foot sprays from the Charles River. There's an unsubstantiated report of a water spout seen on the Charles River. If you look at the major 20th century hurricanes, 3 come to mind. Of course, today's hurricane, the Great Hurricane of 1938, the Atlantic Hurricane of 1944, and Diane in 54. An extratropical cyclone, that's what this hurricane was. And what that means is that as the eye wall diminishes, the duration is prolonged. This storm stalls, and it dumps a ton of rain over New England because it stalls. This moved remarkably fast, being in the Caribbean on September 18th at 8:30 in the morning, 3 days later, striking New York. On September 13th, it was a Category 1, 74-mile-per-hour winds. On the 16th, 98-mile-per-hour winds, a Cat 2. Went to a Category 3 on the 17th, 115-mile-per-hour winds. And then later that day, it escalated to a Category 4, 132-mile-per-hour winds. As it went north of the Dominican Republic, it reached a Category 5 with peak winds of 160-mile-per-hour. It then diminished on the 20th to 155-mile-per-hour winds and then raced northward. When it struck landfall in New York, the sustained winds, the velocity, was 127 miles per hour. We know that this is the most costly disaster in U.S. history up to that year. This thing moved rapidly up the coast at 67 miles per hour. It moved 700 miles in 12 hours. Even if you were warned and you got the word, chances are you couldn't do much about it. When it sustained winds were between 121 miles per hour and 127 miles per hour, top winds at 156 miles per hour, but at the Blue Hills Observatory, they had a gust at 186 miles per hour. There was a 40-foot storm surge in places, and it hit high tide. Seas rose 17 feet in places. Check this out. Salt water sprayed houses in Montpelier, Vermont, which is 120 miles away from the ocean. Southern New England coastal areas were inundated. Most victims drowned. Some had their clothes blown completely off. The first impact of the storm surge registered on seismographs in Alaska. Seawater destroyed vegetation 20 miles inland. All sorts of communities were affected in the six New England states. Let's look at that summer of 38. Well, there was record precipitation in June and July. Sound familiar? It was a muggy August, a really muggy September, and from September 12th to in the 15th, there was 1 inch of rain each day, while the rivers were rising. September 17th through the 20th, constant rain. September 20th was the heaviest rainfall. 13 inches of rain fell in 5 days in the Thames River Basin in Connecticut. Some areas reported 17 inches in 5 days. And of course, with this heavy rain, what do you get? You get soft soil, weak foundations, roots for trees. Trees are ripe to be uprooted. So the hurricane's impact was exacerbated. Let's look at the newspapers of Wednesday, September 21st, 1938. The Treaty of Munich was imminent. Chamberlain, that noodle from England, handed over Sudetenland, the Czechoslovakian area, to Hitler through annexation, despite the protests of Winston Churchill. The Red Sox beat the St. Louis Browns 8-4, but remain 11 games back in the American League. The Lowell Sun's weather forecast, quote, "The weatherman says more rain and cooler tonight and Thursday." Wrong. An editorial, ironically, appears in the New York Times the day of the hurricane. Quote, "Every year an average of three such whirlwinds sweep the tropical North Atlantic between June and November. In 1933, there was an all-time record of 20. If New York and the rest of the world have been so well informed about the cyclone, it is because of an admirably organized meteorological service." Now, they had no tools. Today, if you want me to ask you the weather, we're going to get the weather in every form. In fact, if you go on the computer during June and July, you can probably predict when it's going to rain in your backyard if you're mowing the lawn to an accuracy of 5 to 7 minutes. Well, not back then. At Washington, in the Weather Bureau, a 28-year-old rookie meteorologist named Charlie Pierce, filling in for two vacationing seasoned meteorologists, argues that, according to the data that he's analyzing, the storm is going to be sandwiched between two high-pressure systems, and it's going to head directly north through New England. Longtime veteran Charles Mitchell ignores his forecast. "No hurricane has hit New Jersey or New England during my tenure, and this one will not. This current storm is weakening." Well, air pressure, barometric nosedive, unbelievably low barometric readings. The RMS Carinthia at sea has a reading of 27.85. It's the lowest barometric reading in recorded history in the North Atlantic. He's sitting off the coast of Virginia early on the morning of September 21st. Fire Island, within two hours, went from a low reading of 29.78 to an inconceivable low reading of 27.43 on the 21st of September. And on that same day, a man from West Hampton Beach thought that his new barometer that he got in the mail was broken when it measured 28. While he was at the post office sending it back, his house was blown away. The father of typhoons, On the Red Star liner Königstein, skipper Alfred Leidig has a barometer reading of 28.40 with 100-mile-per-hour winds. On September 19th, Reverend Ernest Gerzi, an Italian Jesuit with 23 years of meteorological experience, while on board the Italian liner Conte di Savoia, bound for New York City, states, quote, "One of my children will be around in about 3 days." This is after he checked the weather charts, barometric readings, and sky conditions. And then New York City. It hits. There's an average gale force wind of 65 miles per hour, which puts it in the tropical storm category. New York gets 4.5 inches of rain. The city is at a standstill from 3 o'clock in the afternoon to 6 o'clock. Thousands are marooned in office buildings. Extensive flooding of streets and basements. At 8:45 p.m., a power failure at Consolidated Edison left all the Bronx and parts of Manhattan in darkness. The only death was a hitchhiker who abandoned the stalled car of a patron who gave him a ride, and he was quickly carried away by the current and drowned. At Fort Schuyler Road, Throgs Neck in New York, they had 9-foot waters at 7:30 p.m. The storm's first hero, J. Gilbert Finning, age 40, William McGrath, 30. Well, these two guys, during the evacuation of Fort Schuyler Road, when J. Gilbert Finning slips and falls while pushing an elderly woman in a boat, McGrath goes after him. Both drown. McGrath is posthumously awarded the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission's Bronze Medal. It was also nicknamed the Long Island Express because it came onto Long Island so quickly. And this photograph, if you can't see it, shows the exposure of Long Island to the forces of the Atlantic Ocean. And Long Island was devastated. Trees knocked down everywhere. Now, with the bravery comes the selfishness. And I'm afraid that if a hurricane hit nowadays, you'd be fat on the selfishness side and thin on the bravery side. A lot of people are so selfish in this day and age. Well, some wealthy homeowners forced their servants to remain in their mansions and cottages while they evacuated, sealing their fate. One account had a family with friends packed into a car that drove off with their servants watching in ankle-deep rising water on their driveway. Some pets and horses were left behind to fend for themselves and subsequently were drowned in the storm surge. After a tree fell on his car, a man on Long Island frantically shook a police officer saying, "That car's brand new. Who can I sue? Who can I sue?" Of course, there was substantial looting. East Hampton, New York, took the brunt of the storm. Trees knocked over. Traffic brought to a standstill. In West Hampton, Long Island, and as you know, the Hamptons are very affluent communities, 28 dead, 4 missing, 153 of 179 houses destroyed. The Long Island Expressway was blocked off in several places. Bridgehampton, New York, heavy casualties. Of the estimated 2 billion trees that were lost in the Northeast, 3,500 trees were lost in the Bridgehampton, Sagaponack, Hayground area alone. The elms and locust trees that formed a half-mile-long arch over Main Street had been planted before the American Revolution and can still be seen in the canvases of many important artists. When the storm was over, 42% of the Main Street elms were gone. So 2 billion trees down were few years before World War II or getting involved in World War II. A lot of this lumber will help houses get built and will help fuel the war effort. It also sets the stage for forest fires. In 1941, in April 21st, in Brant Rock, there was the Great Brant Rock Fire. 600 structures were destroyed, not alive was lost. That day, there were 200 fires blowing through Massachusetts, and that was due to dry conditions, a heavy west wind, and very, very dry timber and kindlewood, fallen trees from GH-38. Nassau, Long Island, coastal communities. In those days, people would build right up to the waterfront. There weren't seawalls. All their houses swept away. In Dune Deck, Bayside, New York, the ocean-torn inlet between West Hampton Beach and Quogue, 400 feet wide and 20 feet deep. Waves broke on lawns 1 mile inland. 6 miles south of Bayshore, across Great South Bay, Saltaire, these are communities, lost 125 houses. Kismet and Fair Harbor, 91 houses. Oak Beach, 29 houses. Ocean Beach and Point of Woods. Far Island in New York was devastated. Over 200 homes had been perched on dunes 20 foot high in Far Island. The next day, it was just one long sand spit. Man by the name of Frederick Foster Durham. He's 54 years old, the vice president of the Fulton Trust Company. Well, his normal New York train is marooned in Warwick, Rhode Island. Normally, it's a 15-minute trip. This time, it took 2 hours. He got home at 8 o'clock at night, and as he washed up for dinner, he dropped dead from exhaustion and exposure. Have you seen my mommy? At Saltaire, the morning after the storm, a young blonde girl sits on a box. As Chief Assistant D.A. Lindsay Henry arrives, the little girl asks, "Could you please assist us in the search for a body?" "Well, of course, young lady. Whose body is it?" She shut her eyes tightly. "My mom's." Some heroes. West Hampton Police Chief Stanley Teller. Police Officer Timothy Robinson saved 17 people. Halfway across the West Bay Bridge, these two men abandoned their two cruisers and waded and swam the rest of the way. They saved a helpless woman and her three children in deep water on Dune Road. They led all 17 people they found onto the roof of a house. A huge wave swept the house off of its foundation. 3 hours later, all 17 land at Quogue, having crossed the bay. No lives were lost. Now, here's my favorite story, the flight of the Burghards. I'm trying to give you a feel for a family that's exposed to this hurricane in New York and what they went through. George and Mabel Burghard. They have two dogs, a fox terrier named Bitsy and a cocker spaniel named Peter. They also have caretakers, servants, Carl and Selma Dalen. Well, they rented a cottage, and this cottage was 75 feet from the top of a 9-foot sand dune, 100 feet from Dune Road, and 75 feet from the Coast Guard station. The distance to the ocean water's edge was 200 feet. The neighbors had their 30-foot cabin cruiser moored to the dock between the houses. So they're built right up on the water. 10 o'clock in the morning. The wind blows strong from the north. The skies are overcast. There's drizzle, and the seas are thick and heavy. An hour later, 11 o'clock, the winds shift to the east, then to the northeast at gale force. Dalen reports water bubbling through the concrete floor of the garage. He thinks that it's fresh water from the bay. They taste it. It's salt water. Mabel goes upstairs and puts on her swimsuit. Noontime. The neighbor's boat is now drifting. Burghard calls Chief Botswain's mate James Ketchum at Mauritius Coast Guard Station, 3 miles to the west of their location. Ketchum says, "I'll be right down." 1 o'clock. Radio station WESF. "We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this report. The West Indies hurricane is in the mid-Atlantic and will blow out to sea." The electric power at this point is still on. 1:30 p.m. A friend of the Burghards, Bill Ottman, calls and says his garage was just blown into the bay. 2 o'clock. 90-mile-per-hour winds shift to the east. The water is now 2 feet deep in the Burghards' garage. Mabel is sewing in the sunroom with her back to the bay windows. Mrs. Dalen tells her to change her seat. Just as she does, the window blows out with glass shards everywhere. 2:30 p.m. The wind and the rain intensify. The bathhouse is swept away. 3 o'clock. And again, at that point, that's their outhouse. They don't have indoor plumbing. 3 o'clock. Burghard tells Dalen to pack up the clothes and move to the third floor. 3:10 p.m., a wave breaks through the back door and sweeps Dalen off his feet. He's the servant, remember, an elderly gentleman. 3:30 p.m., John Avery of the Coast Guard comes across the meadow. Quote, "Come on, people, let's get moving quick. We got no time to lose. Let's go." High tide was due at 6:10 p.m. Burghard stuffs his tennis tickets for the match at Forest Hills on the 22nd into his pocket. Priorities. 4 o'clock. Mabel Burghard picks up Peter, and George picks up Bitsy, the two dogs. The Dalens, much older, are dilly-dallying. The wind is now up over 100 miles per hour. It's a half-mile walk to the bridge across the bay. They got to get to that bridge. Mrs. Dalen is being nearly dragged by Avery, the Coast Guard guy. Old Carl Dalen clings to the fence post back in the driveway as the group begins to move down the road. He's not letting go. Carl then sits down on the fence, exhausted, head down. He's now 75 feet behind them. So imagine trying to walk into a headwind of 100 miles an hour. That'll tucker you out pretty quickly. He can't hear their call because the wind's blowing in the other direction. Mrs. Dalen is now hysterical for her husband. Can you imagine your loved one evacuating and seeing your loved one not coming with you? The wind suddenly shifts to the southeast at 110 miles per hour, and here come the 50-foot breakers roaring over the sand dunes. Flotsam drifts by in the raging sea torrents. There's a boat tied to the dock, and the group quickly moves towards it. It's 4:15 p.m. With a sickening crash, the Coast Guard station hits the bay and smashes to pieces. Just then, the line snaps, and the boat, their only salvation, is dragged out to sea. Electric wires hit the ocean. They hit puddles. Electrocution is a distinct possibility. Now, Mrs. Dalen, she straggles 50 feet behind the group, refusing to move, and she's calling to her husband, who is 125 feet behind. The Burghardts, with their dogs under their arms, go out onto a broken dock and lie down. They're hoping to ride this thing out like a surfboard. Just then, a large, flat piece of wooden siding comes by, and Mabel, George, the dogs, and Coast Guardman Avery climb onto it. The wind had driven the bay water across the mainland with such force that about 200 feet, the bay bottom was dry. It's almost like a tsunami. The storm surge actually moves the water so there's dry ocean bottom could be seen. The Dalens are helpless. The Burghardts and Avery jump off the board and wait for a giant wave that takes them 200 feet out into the bay. 6-foot waves continually wash them off the board, and they climb right back on. They dodge flotsam, cars, jagged glass, and boards with nails that were moving quickly by them. They place the dogs on a trailer raft, a little raft that they trail behind theirs. Well, Bitsy's washed off, but Peter grabs him by the ear and drags him back to the raft. They paddle around huge chunks of houses and debris. Ducks fly backwards at 40 miles per hour. The raft is finally grounded in berry bushes. Bitsy disappears in the brush. They land 1 mile west from their house at Onek, across the bay, and they head to higher ground at the golf course. They've been swept a mile across the bay. They wave down a car and make their way into West Hampton. Avery moves off to help more people. Some of their personal belongings are found miles away from their house. When the Dalen's bodies are located, Carl's found near the golf course, near where they landed, and he had broken his leg. Coast Guardsman John Avery, cited for his bravery. Wood is pierced through wood like an arrow. Every street corner has an armed man looking for looters. There's a period of price gouging over the next 48 hours. There's that selfishness motif again. And that awful sea smell stuck around for over a year. Quogue, New York. They use the gym as a morgue. There's a breach at Shinnecock Inlet. Water pushes its way through Shinnecock, the peninsula, and forms two islands. Once it's breached, it changes the currents in New York Harbor. The heroes of Stony Point. Here's a photo of beavers there, folks. Well, 60 colonies of beavers from the Adirondacks built 60 dams. There were about 500 beavers. The dams in Palisades Park held back swollen rivers and ponds. Well, these beavers worked all through the night of the hurricane to fortify their bulwarks. These beavers knew something was up. I just want to add something. Has everybody noticed the unusual squirrel activity? Trying to get in your houses and collect acorns, and they're running around. I don't like that. That tells me we got a tough winter ahead of us. We're going to get some big storms. Well, Long Mountain Beaver Pond doubled in size from 5 to 10 acres due to the dam made of mud, sticks, stones, and sods. So what they did is they dissipated the water with their dam. It was 150 yards long and 6 feet high, and it held fast. It only spilled 18 inches of water over its top. Cedar Hill Pond Dam doubled in size to 8 acres. It was 40 feet wide, and the water rose 2 feet. Now, our little heroes here, what they did is they saved 5 arterial highways that were used for evacuation during the hurricane. They saved Long Mountain Road, Johnstown Road, U.S. Highways 617, and Route 9 West, the heroes of Stony Point. The plight of the Park City. A ferry leaves Port Jefferson, New York at 2 o'clock for a 2-hour run to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Captain Ray Dickerson tries to turn back, but the wind shift forces him to drop anchor. Rogue waves fill the hold with over 5 feet of water, and at 3:15, fires under boilers went out, stopping the steam engine cold. The anchor finally caught at 7:30 p.m. as the crew bailed out the engine room. Most passengers spent the entire night seated in their cars. The ship was spotted at 7 a.m. and towed to safety by a Coast Guard cutter, but it was a 21-hour odyssey. The southeast coast of Connecticut was slammed from Saybrook Point to Stonington. One of the stories comes of a chicken farmer in Long Island who had banded the legs of his chicken the day before. Well, the hurricane killed all the chickens, and one, allegedly, was found in Westport, Connecticut, blown across Long Island Sound. One of my favorite stories alone, this is a lecture in itself, is the derailed train outside Stonington, Connecticut, known as the Bostonian. The Bostonian had 275 passengers, returning many students to prep schools. Well, at 3:30 p.m., the railroads were ordered to halt, and the train fireman checks the tracks, and the water is rising rapidly. They should evacuate. Well, the engineer got the engine moving on the fourth try, plowing debris and dragging wires. One of his men dives into the water and manages to uncouple the derailed cars. Before this, the engineer had to go in there, the conductor, with an axe, a fire axe, and threaten the students to, number one, shut up, and number two, get in the front car. There were people that had just been served dinner, and they refused to get up from their table because they had just been served dinner. And he swept it off the tables and said, you're going to go or you're going to go out in the water. Your choice. Well, he saved many lives when they finally rolled into the Stonington station. In Danielson, Connecticut, the famous picture is the toppling of the 120-year-old steeple. Katharine Hepburn. We're in Old Saybrook, Connecticut. What about Katharine Hepburn? Well, she's considered to be box office poison at this point in 1938. She had just auditioned for a film that was about to commence production. So with her boyfriend, Red Hammond, she went and played golf. It was very humid and breezy that day. And on the par 3 ninth hole, she scored a hole-in-one. She finished with her best round ever of golf, an incredible 31 on 9 holes. Afterwards, she and Red went for a swim in front of the house. She stated about the breezy weather and the rising surf, quote, something very special is going to happen. Well, the family had an elegant summer house in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, and they'd had it there since the turn of the century. Kate's brother Dick was working on a script for a movie. Kate was waiting to hear if she got the part of Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind. She had just finished making Bringing Up Baby earlier in the year, which was a bust. The water rose 17 feet high. Dick and Catherine got the family out as 2 chimneys crumbled and their guest house was swallowed up in the water and drifted a half mile away. Family heirlooms were lost in the mud. Well, after the storm, Dick found his typewriter and scripts in perfect tact. But days later, when Kate got home, she was on her knees, inebriated, digging in vain for her family's jewelry as Red tugged gently on her shoulders and said, honey, it's time to leave. The Battle of Colt's Dyke, the Connecticut River in Hartford. 1,200 WPA workers, World War I vets, college students and volunteers fight to keep 1 million tons of water out of the south end of the city that was devastated in the great floods of 1936. Army engineers say that there's a 50-50 chance that the bulwark will hold when the water crests at a projected 28 feet. A plan to dynamite Clark's Dyke should it not hold. This is to save the industrial area. Do you save the residential area or do you save the city's industrial area? The latter was chosen. The Connecticut River at Hartford. On this photo, if you can see it, an arrow points to the Traveler's Insurance Tower, and the clock in the old State House stopped at 4:10 p.m. Mrs. Carl Carlson, driving towards Guilford, Connecticut, was stopped in traffic as they removed a tree from the road. She picked up a book to read. Just then, a tree came crashing down on her car, killing her instantly. The book she was reading was Gone with the Wind. In Hartford, the river rose 4 inches per hour. Matt Strong caught a 5-pound bass with his bare hands on Main Street. Frank Fredsall's apple tree was blown over and then later blown upright, and it yielded fruit for a few years after that. In New London, storm surge, 110 miles per hour winds, and a great fire. The steamship Tulip is washed up onto the railroad tracks. In Cheshire, Patrick Joyce is killed when he's hurled against the brick wall of a prison building. We'll tell you about that great fire in New London in just a moment. Then on to Rhode Island. People were not prepared. Remember, nobody got the word. Let's look at one family, the Moore family. They're washed out at Watch Hill. 11 people, including 3 servants, crammed into the attic of a sturdy house on the edge of Little Narragansett Bay. Mr. Moore had suffered a heart attack that morning, but managed to still board up the house. The roof was ripped off and thrown into the sea. Entire family jumps into an ad hoc raft. Huge waves crash on them. Hammerhead sharks follow the raft. They floated across the peninsula, the bay, and drifted into a cove on Barn Island. All 11 people huddle in an abandoned barn, and they watch the glow of the New London fire. Finally, they're rescued by the lobstermen the next day on the 22nd. All 39 houses on Watch Hill were wiped off the face of the earth. It's now a sand dune today. A 20-mile stretch from Napatree Point to Point Judith, 175 people were killed. Can't see this photo, but you can see, and what were they thinking? You have buildings and edifices and nightclubs built right up on the water. Well, the next day, the water won, buildings and nightclubs nothing. The storm hit westerly Rhode Island at 3:50 p.m., and 100 people were killed. 194 of 200 homes were destroyed. 50 bodies were washed up in sand dunes at Misquamicut Beach in Rhode Island. Misquamicut Beach suffered tremendous devastation. At Island Park, Rhode Island, 19 people were killed. 198 of 200 houses destroyed. In Newport, Rhode Island, storm surge right through the tidal marsh wiped out a neighborhood. The destruction along Narragansett Bay in Conemaugh, Rhode Island, 100 homes were destroyed there. Oakland Beach, 100 people made homeless. A woman says, "My baby has just been blown out of my arms." Jamestown, Rhode Island, 14 people perished in Barrington. The Governor Carr Ferry is washed ashore. In fact, on Block Island, 86 of 100 boats were destroyed. The 3 most common phrases that were heard after the hurricane hit: where do I go now? Everything that I own is gone. And of course, I had no insurance. The rats at Brown University, and I'm not talking about the people who work in the bursar's office there. The calls began coming into a couple of local exterminators that mice had infested a woman's dormitory and that rats were seen at the library at Brown University. Were they seeking higher ground at College Hill? Many cats and dogs went missing on the morning of the hurricane. Squirrels and birds were reportedly moving about in an agitated manner, according to residents of Plymouth. Providence flood. The city became a perfect funnel and aqueduct. The storm surge struck at 5:15, just as power went out and people were leaving their offices. A white wall of water rushed up Providence River, a deluge of water 13 feet high in some city streets. Providence Hall and the Biltmore Hotel washed out. Providence River rose 17 feet in 70 minutes. Appliances and consumer goods floated down the streets from department stores. A canoe washed up at Exchange Place in downtown Providence and sat there for several days afterwards. The Monhegan, a steamer, was sunken and wedged into a pier near downtown Providence. Something I call Wedding Splashers, a play on that dreadful movie Wedding Crashers. Joe Fogle and Lorraine Martin are scheduled to get married on the 21st of September on the second floor in the ballroom of the Narragansett Hotel in downtown Providence. Where's Joe? Not cold feet. He's stuck at Union Station with his family. Well, 500 refugees seek shelter from the storm in the hotel. What'd they do? They feasted on the wedding banquet and drank all the champagne. Joe shows up at 11 o'clock and they're married by candlelight by an anxious minister who wants to get home. They take a short walk on smelly, muddy streets, the water had receded by 10 o'clock, to their honeymoon suite at the Biltmore Hotel. The Mary Poppins of Brant Rock, Brant Rock, a part of Marshfield. A 9-year-old boy in Brant Rock, Mass., saw that the weather was getting wild late in the afternoon of September 21st, 1938. He decided to heighten the exhilaration of the storm by getting his grandfather's best umbrella out of the closet and climbing up onto the garage roof. He jumps off the roof, thinking that he might even fly. As he tumbled to the ground, the umbrella was bent and broken. He received what's known as red bottom for his poor judgment. That boy was my father. Massachusetts South Coast, eyewitness to the storm surge that hit Horseneck Beach to Buzzards Bay at 5 o'clock. An eyewitness sees this wall of water. Do you remember that tsunami that hit New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve, Indonesia? Well, quote, here's what he says. A long black band is approaching. It's a solid black wall of water, and it looks like an unusually large black roller coming into the shore with its top being blown off, so that if it doesn't curl up, it'll break like an ordinary wave. There are 30-foot waves at Horseneck Beach. 41 people perish in Fall River. Ships, boats, barges are torn off their moorings and docks. The oil tanker Phoenix spills its cargo and is blown across the river onto lawns. In New Bedford, 9 cotton mills are destroyed. 10,000 employees are jobless. The New Bedford economy would never recover from this storm. Just as the Portland Gale of 1898 destroys Provincetown and knocks it off the map as a major fishing port, so goes New Bedford with GH-38. You'll see another community, though, prosper from this in a moment. The Acushnet River rises 11 feet. 1,500 people are homeless in Fairhaven. I didn't even know there would be even 1,500 homes in Fairhaven at that time. Well, the fishing fleets are overdue. In the New Bedford Standard Times, quote, women stood with babies in their arms and watched the horizon and the ageless manner of wives whose men ply the sea. Others went from boat to boat asking questions. Everywhere, the answer was a simple negative shake of the head. Westport Harbor, flooded out. New Bedford, devastated. Woods Hole, swamped. Wareham, raked. And Hurricane Bob, which wasn't even a hurricane, it wasn't even a tropical storm. It was a hiccup compared to this hurricane. But the devastation that it did to Wareham looked like fighter jets dropped bombs on it. That was in 1991. I saw that firsthand, August. Bourne Bridge, a famous photo, shows National Guardsmen mourning the tragedy of a family who died in their house that's wedged underneath the Bourne Bridge, 1938. In Martha's Vineyard, there are 25-foot waves at Chilmark. In Menemsha, the bridge from Gay Head to Menemsha was washed out. There were storm damages in East Brookfield, Mass., New Bedford, Mass., Springfield, Mass., East Bridgewater, Mattapoisett, Taunton, Newton, Fairhaven, Wareham, West Brookfield, Ware, Mass., Worcester, North Uxbridge, Putnam, Connecticut. Downtown Boston, tree fell on Arlington Street. Massachusetts State House is blocked off. The hatch shell in the Esplanade, Charles River, Boston, drowned out. When will you see that? Lexington Green, historic Lexington Green, American Revolution, trees down everywhere on the battlefield. Exeter, New Hampshire now as we move north, devastation. Peterborough, New Hampshire was flooded out. The headlines, the Boston Post, 45 killed in wild hurricane, property damaged in the millions, hundreds hurt by wreckage. A little premature on that one. Then the Boston Evening Globe says hurricane dead, 250 people die. Nope. Then the Daily News says 322 people die in the storm, only 37 in New York. Wrong again. Deaths now 390, according to the Daily Record. Boston Herald, storm deaths mount to 515, 100,000 homeless, whole towns wiped out. In floods, 250 die in Rhode Island. Let's look at some of the facts of the hurricane. Peak steady winds, 121 miles per hour. Peak gusts, 186 miles per hour at Blue Hill Observatory. Lowest pressure, 27.94 at Belport, New York. Peak storm surge, 17 feet above normal high tide. Peak wave heights, 50 feet at Gloucester. 700 deaths, 600 in New England. 63,000 homeless. 20,000 miles of power wires knocked down. 8,900 homes and buildings destroyed. 3,300 boats lost. 26,000 automobiles lost. 2 billion trees destroyed. $6.2 million in 1938 dollars. That's $15 billion in 1998. And now with the running of the mints, that's probably worth closer to $25 billion. Shirley Ann Gatz was born at 328 at Eastern Long Island Hospital just as the roof blew off and flooded the delivery room. Whenever I do this lecture, I always meet a hurricane baby, and I met a fellow who was 3 weeks premature due to the hurricane. So couple that, women are going into labor earlier. Great Atlantic hurricanes, just some other hurricanes here. 1944 went up the coast and basically traveled the same track as her hurricane in 1938. They tend to go up the Connecticut River Valley. Edna, 1954. Same track, just by, except this one went a little east and went over the canal, or just the east of the canal. Carol, again, right up the gut, same track that GH-38 took. Diane, 1955. When inland in North Carolina swept across Jersey and scraped southern New England. Donna, 1960. Again, went over Florida, back to sea, over Cape Hatteras, and went right up the Connecticut River Valley. So if you look at the great hurricanes, aside from Katrina, Katrina is the greatest natural disaster ever. 1938 hurricane, of course, they weren't naming hurricanes till the 50s. That ranks top five all time. So, when the cyclops comes, when a hurricane comes, scientific studies have shown that a gallon of milk and a loaf of bread are not your best protection against a major storm. The cows shudder when storms come because their udders will hurt. Check the tides. Stay away from the beach. When people tell you to leave, you leave. Do not panic in a traffic jam. Shut off your engine to conserve fuel. Know where the high ground is in your town and neighborhood. The winds will shift. Don't count on the wind to blow constantly in one direction. If you can, and this is the most important thing, it's the most difficult thing to do because it weighs so much, is carry clean drinking water. And stay away from down power lines if possible, containing down lines. And be aware that trees and houses can topple in an instant. Swimming against the current, not advised. Within 2 miles of the coast, vulnerable to surge. And if I always say, if you're a clown, you certainly will drown. One of the things that happened was Springfield, Mass., which was suffering during the Depression, and again, this is at the end of the Depression, is that there were thousands of jobs that were formed through the WPA for the reconstruction and the highway acts that were going through. So whereas New Bedford suffered, Springfield actually saw a boon to their economy. Now, the 21st century hurricane blast zone. Well, where in Winthrop. Are you people vulnerable to a hurricane? You certainly are. You're in a peninsula. In fact, the place called Port Shirley and Fort Dawes, that'll be the island of Shirley, the island of Dawes one day. Okay, but yes, Winthrop is extremely vulnerable to hurricanes. My resources I suggest you buy or get from the library: A Wind to Shake the Earth by Everett Allen, The Great Hurricane in 1938, Cherie Burns, wonderful book, Sudden Sea by R.A. Scotty, and The Hurricane in 1938 by Aram Gutsuzian. My name's John Horrigan. It's been a pleasure talking to you this morning. Thank you very much. Now, usually I ask questions and I say, does anybody have any recollections? But looking around the room, you're all too young and you weren't around in 1938, so.
I have a question.
You have a question?
Yeah. You spoke about a lot of squirrels at this time. You spoke about the rains of the summer. Are you alluding to the fact that perhaps we'll have a storm of magnitude?
I know no more than the old Farmer's Almanac. In fact, the old Farmer's Almanac predicted that October snowstorm that we had last month. I just think that the weather patterns are changing, and you should recognize that, being with over the ages. Terrible harvest this year in New England. I'm studying something known as the Year Without a Summer. It took place in 1816 due to volcanic activity, okay, and due to a low number of sunspots. We had extraordinary aberrations in the weather, extreme temperatures high and low, violent storms. And as I talk to you here, late 2009, as we close out this decade, we're in an extremely low sunspot period, number one. And number two, I liken the car pollution, the pollution that's being exhausted into the atmosphere, akin to a volcano going off. So the conditions are ripe for the climate to change. I don't want to say global warming. I think that's the wrong term. What I like to call it is artificially induced climate change. And I'm not concerned about global warming. You know, enjoy the longer summer. It's the global cooling, because you block that sun out, you put pollution, and the sunlight stops hitting Earth. Game, set, match, ball game. We're all done as a species. And I'll debate Al Gore or the right-wing industrialist who says it's natural on that. But does anybody have a comment on? Okay, let's go back to the 38. I'm sorry, that was my. Yes.
In 1938, I was 8 years old, and I was a stubborn brat. I wanted to stay out in the back porch to watch the wind and the rain and everything. And it was really fierce. My mother kept trying to pull me in the house, and I said, "No, I just want to watch it. I'll be fine." And I was behind the porch boards watching, and one split second, this huge tree in the next yard over went tumbling down. I gave one scream and ran in the house. My mother had to put me in the front hallway at the time. It was dark. It was so dark that day, too. And she put a coat over my head. I was so frightened that so I wouldn't see or hear anything else anymore. That's how stubborn I was.
I hear countless stories like that people are sitting, their parents, their kids. You know, obviously, a lot of the people that I'm talking to now were very young then. And mother says, "You come away from there, just one more second. You come away now." And as they come away now, a tree smashes on their porch or something comes through the window. So that's what I call providence.
Yeah, this went the other way.
Does anybody else have any recollections they'd like to share? Yes.
I was 12, and we lived in Charlestown then on the fourth floor of a big building. My parents had 13 children, so they had two apartments, one on each side of this big corridor. Our father left to find the two oldest boys who didn't have the sense enough to come home when the storm got there. And after a while, my mother left to try and find my father.
Wow.
And so I have one sister older than I am. And the two of us were left with probably 10 little kids, smaller than I was 12. She was 13. And we were left with probably 11 or 12 little kids to take care of. And the roof went off over our heads.
Oh.
So we went downstairs to the second floor, and we parked all of those little kids in the hallway. And we just sat there until the storm was gone.
That was smart. You went to the hallway, the interior structure.
My older sister and I both remember that very clearly. The younger kids just remember that it was a very exciting storm, and the roof went off. But you hear lots of people older than you, John Horrigan, who tell stories like that. I would like to know, John, I know you speak on the year of no summer. What other stories do you tell?
I'm speaking on Amelia Earhart, called Where Are You, Amelia Earhart. I'm doing that on Friday in Medford, where she lived for a while. I do another one called Glenn Miller's Missing. Just we look at the life, biography, and music of Glenn Miller, and then what happened that fateful day in 1944 when he went missing. As you mentioned, The Year Without a Summer. And another program that I'm working on right now, well, that I've given, in fact, I'm going to turn it into an audio CD, and somebody's interested in even writing a screenplay for it. It's called The Robinson Crusoes of Wake Island. And people forget about Wake Island, but it was bombed the same day as Pearl Harbor in 1941. And Wake Island, the guys there, you had 1,500 civilian workers, about 500 soldiers there. And essentially, they had six big guns, and they sunk three Jap ships and repelled an invasion. And the rumor says that when they were asked by Washington, do you need anything, they said, yes, yeah, send more Japs. They never said that. But anyways, the story is these two men, when the island was occupied and invaded on December 23rd, 1941, hid out on their bellies in the brush for 4 months while Japanese soldiers just walked yards away looking for them. And they lived off of food rations that they'd stashed in different areas of the scrub brush. So that's called the Robinson Crusoes of Wake Island. So those are some of the storms. And then the other one are great snowstorms of New England. That's another one that I'm working on.
Oh, that was kind of sad. In the blizzard of 78, I lived three houses from the ocean. And we didn't have any water, any running water, 4 feet of water in the cellar. Of course, it was in the middle of February. And no heat. And then the... somehow or other, the wires down the cellar caught fire, and they were starting to go right to the box, the electrical box.
Mm.
And my son, he happened to have hip boots on, and he went down the cellar, and my dog hid someplace. We didn't know where he was, and he went down the cellar and took buckets of water. And he put out the fire on this electrical line going towards the box. I don't know how he did it. Otherwise, my house would have went up in flames.
Sure, sure.
And then the house I had next to a lot of land.
This is Winthrop you're talking about, obviously.
No, Point of Pines, Revere.
Revere, okay.
And I happened to have an extra lot of land next to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And the two houses next to me went up in flames. And went burnt right to the ground. The
wow.
Firemen come down in front loaders because they couldn't get water out of the hydrants. I mean, they had to drag the hose all the way from the corner down the street. They fought the fire from my yard, and I would help them come in my house. I'd make coffee. But my son would go out in the yard, get the snow. I'd melt the snow on the stove, and that's how I made the coffee, black coffee.
Wow.
And then I'd take liquor, brandy, and put it in every cup of whiskey,
go.
Whatever I had for them.
The cure-all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the next morning, the tiles of my kitchen floor had all lifted up because from the firemen, you know, their wet coats and things. That was, and then we had, what happened down my basement was that the oil tank, when the water came in, the force of the water lifted the oil tank up.
Wow.
And the spout broke.
And you have an oil spill in your basement.
So I had oil and water in my bulkhead. The dirt came down. I had oil, water, and dirt in my basement.
Are you still in the same house?
I was until a year ago.
Okay.
But we had to get out when we started smelling the air. We got out.
Did you say you were trying to the biggest snowstorm? What year? Did you just
say 78?
The great 78. You have the blizzard of 78, and if you look at 3-foot snowstorms, great snowstorms, the greatest snow Legend has it is 1717 that hit New England.
No. Is that the snowstorm?
Yes.
There was a big snowstorm as I was growing up. Went up to past the first floor window, almost to the second floor.
Oh, yeah.
There was a snowstorm, mm-hmm. and we couldn't get out of our house. We couldn't get our front door open, and we had Dad to dig tunnels, you know, to the corner to get out.
Was that 40 or 42?
I'm not sure.
How old
that's
do you think you were?
I'm asking you.
That is a big one that hit Boston.
That was a big
78.
One. And
no,
none of my nephews think that I was imagining this thing. And I says, no, I remember
digging it out.
41, right? Just be around Pearl Harbor or just after Pearl Harbor? Okay, that makes sense.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Do you have any of the stories were good, but a raising question, do you have it on tape?
Have this lecture on tape?
Yeah.
It's online on the computer. If you go to johnhorgan.com and you go to my, or U.S. History, www.ushistory.me, it'll take you to this Hurricane 38, and I've given this lecture a dozen times, and you have a dozen different recordings. You'll be sick of me after the first recording.
Very, very interesting.
It was wonderful.
Thank you. Oh, another one, Harriet, is I do the Great Northeast Blackout. I'm looking at blackouts. And I think you're going to see more and more blackouts as the infrastructure of our electric grid gets older. I don't have a card on me, but Harriet has my contact information. Well, thank you very, very much, everybody, and I hope you have a nice winter.